Welcome to In Season, where we explore the farms, gardens, and wild spaces of the Lower Columbia Pacific region. I'm your host, Teresa Retzloff, and with me in the studio today is a fabulous local gardener, Jessica Schleif.
Hello, Teresa.
Hello, Jessica. And we are going to talk today, we're just going to riff on a lot of themes today, but part of it's like what's happening in the gardens in spring. It's now the beginning of June, and things are really popping and growing. There's lots of things to do right now. And I wanted to kind of have a special focus on making the most of your garden space. Your garden space, your farm space, whatever you're growing in, making the most of it. Jessica, if you have not seen some of her work, is a master of making trellises out of strange things. Things that you would not think would be a trellis, and yet suddenly it's a trellis and something's growing up it, and suddenly you have more space in your garden. So, I mean, talk a little bit about how do you like to expand the available space in a garden?
Well, going up is always a good option because there's so much plant material that enjoys that climb up a trellis. And so fun to watch that some of the things I've grown on trellises are hops, runner beans, scarlet runner beans,
some of the pretty blooming things.
Hops, obviously not a temporary thing. There are annuals that you could grow, and there are
things
more
like nasturtiums or sweet peas or
things like that. Yeah. Exactly. Nice little annuals. And some of the things that I've used traditional things like bamboo, mm-hmm. Clippings from the garden. I've actually made them out of old sunflower stalks that were still sturdy and I thought could last a season.
So for some things, especially for annuals, really, it just needs to last that season.
It does.
And then it can all be composted together.
And I think knowing that you can erect something on a temporary or seasonal mm-hmm. basis makes you look at your space differently. It doesn't have to be a lifetime commitment. You could just have fun and go ahead and put up a tower or a teepee-like thing or a wall-based flatter thing. I've used giant miscanthus stalks to make woven panels. Mm-hmm. The bamboo is great. Something that I've been experimenting with a lot are the hog panels. We did a fencing project in our back garden mm-hmm. where we actually enclosed it and we used the galvanized panels, mm-hmm. like hog panels or livestock.
Hog panels?
Livestock panels. Yeah, different sizes. Different sizes.
And then you just mount them on different things.
And I've used those to do some peas and sweet peas this year. I've actually just used some of the extra panels and leaned them. I've also
not even attached them to anything.
Not even attached them. Actually leaned them against the other panel, against the fencing, mm-hmm. and having really good luck with some peas and some sweet peas and coming again beans in the same way. I also work in a community garden space, the Grayskull Community Garden, uh-huh. and using some of those little, even a foot wide little panel sections to grow cucumbers, mm-hmm. To actually almost espalier tomatoes or train tomatoes mm-hmm. up them, squash, because these panels are sturdier and it's the galvanized growing squash. I grew pumpkins last year, mm-hmm. though I ended up having to then move in some little logs and some things that pumpkins could rest on,
making some little slings.
Yeah. And I did that too, making a little sling out of fabric and attaching them to the trellis.
Any of those vining plants, but looking at
your light. Where is your light that's going to grow whatever it is that you want to grow? And perhaps you have sun on the edge of a driveway or against a part of the house where you don't actually have a plant bed. Sometimes container planting can be a really good option there, and you can combine a makeshift trellis with a type of container also.
I know, it's interesting. My sister lives down in San Francisco, and she just showed me sent pictures of her garden, and she had made a container. And it's like commercially available stuff at sort of home improvement stores. It was like these little corner pieces that you could buy that then you slatted boards into. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's maybe not the most beautiful thing, but she has a concrete pad in back of her garden and then open bed space, but all the open bed space had already been planted. And so she built a couple of these things, very proud of herself, got all the boards cut to size mm-hmm. and took it home and assembled the whole thing and then filled it with soil. And she's been growing tons of chard and kale and peas, and she has tomatoes growing in there. And I was amazed at just for the size of these small boxes. And that might also be the thing, too, where there are some easy ways to make a container,
mm-hmm.
you know, a contained space on maybe a concrete surface or a patio.
There's a woman at the community garden that expanded her space some in exactly that same way, and it was a kit.
Yeah,
and I kind of it came,
I
and I kind of thought,
I know, and we're like, it's a kit.
But then there it is. She has an instant 4x4 bed that she filled with compost, so she has.
Yeah.
Exciting, perfect soil, free of
Absolutely.
Morning glory, free of any weeds or, villains that might come along, free of slugs, probably. And bam, she instantly turned that into spring planting with mm-hmm. radishes and things, and then transitioned that into peas and used a trellis, grew the peas up it, and then had greens underneath that had this nice dappled shade that she had created mm-hmm. by trellising up the peas.
Well, and that's a great thing to do, to think about too. Sometimes, I mean, we always talk about how like not having enough access to sun, but some gardens have too much sun.
It's true.
Or
it's
your space might be too hot for things like lettuce or arugula, or more tender greens if you want to grow those, or flowers like pansies or violas or something mm-hmm. that might get really scorched in
afternoon
the sun.
Scorching.
And so if you can create some shade by doing some trellising, that can be a great way to protect those plants and maximize your growing space as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it doesn't, you know, we're talking about some store-bought things, but my experience is sometimes the things that are just laying around in your cleanup process, you can incorporate those things. And a great time to use up. When Marge Teary was still living, often she would have little 4-inch sections of the most beautiful mohair yarns. And it was what she had to cut off when she was looming pieces or doing various things in her studio. And I would just, I'll take all those. And
that's what you used to tie your plants?
That was what I used to tie my plants. I've used ribbons in the past. I've used mm-hmm. Scraps of things from art projects or sewing projects. Mm-hmm. Things that brought me joy, colors that brought me joy, things that gave me a little memory, and to work that into your trellising process.
I know one of the greatest tips that I got was using old tights mm-hmm. or stockings and cutting those, because it's a stretchy, gentle fabric. And they would often last for several years. Like you just cut the legs off
I've
and then
seen
cut strips
people.
Of them and then cut them in half, you know, cut a whole thing in them. And they look a bit goofy, although if you get really multicolored tights or, you know, somebody you know likes to wear wild colored tights, not just nylon stockings, but those were great for me too, for things that do, there are many plants that won't just naturally climb themselves or they can't support themselves as they climb.
So having little tiny helpers along the way.
And sometimes you need to guide them too. Things like beans, they will naturally climb, but sometimes you need to guide those vines into where you want them to climb.
In a gentle manner.
Yes.
And that's I know I have to, I'm doing that with the peas quite a bit right now, and I've done it with sweet peas and the hops and things that they're going to get there on their own, but they might end up somewhere partly down on the ground and then winding through something else. So that meditation, that's a lovely morning or evening meditation to go and spend some time with those vining mm-hmm. plants and see, can I just pop these little pea tendrils back into the trellis and they'll grow a little bit more and then pop back out for the sun.
Push them back in very gently. I know it's just all about encouraging and watching how they grow. And it's exciting to me to see ways that people can get more out of their space. I mean, a lot of gardens, you know, there's some limitations on space. I mean, it's hard for me to remember what that's like because I'm working with such a huge space.
Tracy, you're reading my mind as you were just talking about this, and even in the introduction, I thought, what does she know about space limitations? She's not wandering around her garden with a golden foliaged pineapple sage looking for
just
some square inch of soil that doesn't have something in it, like in my garden
right now. Trying to get 300 feet of tomatoes in the ground. So it's a different thing, but I think, I mean, farmers, I think, deal with the same thing where, you know, you're trying to maximize how much you get out of your bed space. You're trying to rotate your crop so you're not growing the same thing in the same space. And it's definitely like a, you know, musical chairs, you know, jigsaw puzzle of moving things around and trying to make sure that, you know, what you're planting here isn't going to shade that crop that's in the row next to it. And it does make me really think about, you know, when I'm planting rows of pole beans, then leaving a row in between that I can grow lettuce in, mm-hmm. because I know that there's going to be some dappled light depending on where the sun's coming from. And so, oh, that's a great place to plant those crops that can take a little bit of that shade. And for the ones that really do need the sun, place them somewhere else. And it is a bit of moving things around. I have the luxury of having more space to do that on our farm, but it's the same principle in a garden. It's just understanding what your space is and knowing how to work with it.
And that, exactly what you're saying, the understanding what your space is and taking the time to, even if you've been in a garden for a number of years, taking the time to really look at where your sun is, pay attention to some of the microclimates within your soil.
Well, and the sun changes throughout the season,
it's
too.
True.
So where it is in the summer is going to be different from where it is in the winter. And then if you live in a city or a town and you have, you know, neighboring trees or shrubs or stuff like that, those may be growing and changing the light in your garden.
It's true.
Changing the dynamics your space. And some of that you may be able to control. Some of it may be a neighbor's tree that they don't want to cut down. And so you're going to have to adapt to that over time.
And not fighting against each of those spaces. You know, really, sometimes it's hard for us to admit where we are at.
Where are we at?
admitting to some of those shadier spaces, really looking at that and thinking about how you can use it to your benefit, not working against the plant material, really thinking about what the requirements are for these two tomatoes that you're planting in your home garden, or these three pepper plants that you're planting in your home garden, or cucumbers and the crop rotation. I can't even, I try to think about it.
It is really challenging. And I think in a small garden, it's difficult because sometimes like the only spot you have that gets good sun.
Yeah.
There's just one spot. And so if you want to grow those heat lovers, that's where it's got to be. And that can be a real challenge. In that sense, I would say it's just like really good sanitation practices and try and be really careful about how you're watering and try not to let disease build up.
Sure.
I mean, if you ever see a plant that has any signs of disease, pull it out.
Right.
That's the hard part. Or, you know, do things in containers where you can change out the soil. Because that's where a lot of those problems for things like tomatoes and peppers and eggplants and everything in that family, a lot of the diseases that they get are soil-borne diseases. And, you know, once it's there in the soil, you know, you get some of those wilts, the fusarium and verticillium wilts.
Yeah.
It's really hard to get it out.
Yeah.
It takes years. And, you know, that's just a challenge. Sometimes we can't have everything that we want. I mean, I feel like that's one of the biggest meditations. You use the word meditation. I'm thinking about the thing that I think about a lot is that there's all these things that I would like to grow, or all these things that I would like to have, or all these situations that in an ideal world, this is exactly how it would be laid out. But that rarely ever happens.
Mm-hmm.
And I think especially in a home garden, you're often limited by certain characteristics of your garden, and you may not be able to grow everything that you want.
Or you may not be able to grow all the varieties of those things that you want. I've definitely noticed with some of the tomatoes, some of the peppers, pinpointing mm-hmm. varietals that'll work in this place. And yes, yeah. you may still not have the sun. You still may not have some of the yeah. things that are required for yeah. that. But boy, we can do a containered cherry tomato in a sunny spot, and it's pretty much guaranteed you're going to have tomatoes here.
Tomatoes. Yeah,
I think
will.
We get discouraged sometimes because those beefsteak, those giant tomatoes are possibly not available to us, depending on the season, depending on the sighting.
It's hard because those have been such a standard that's been set in our culture of mm-hmm. like what a tomato is.
Big better.
Tomatoes. And just, even if you're like, you know, into sort of the more heirloom organic stuff, like those huge, those beautiful heirlooms, like, you know, the Amish
yeah.
tomatoes. And a lot of those are, the flavor's amazing. They look kind of weird, but they're also beautiful. But really big fruits like that are hard to ripen in our climate because we just don't have the nighttime, warmer nights mm-hmm. and longer days that they need, longer hot days. And the same thing with peppers too. And this is something that I get asked a lot from people about, you know, well, you know, do you have habanero plants? Do you have, like, you know, all these different hot peppers? And I'm like, I don't even.
We don't have the heat
we
here.
Just don't, yeah, and it's an actual chemical reaction in the plants that they need hot temperatures to really develop the heat in the pepper. And so I can grow a jalapeno here, and it'll have a bit of a bite to it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not embarrassed by my jalapenos. Some people sneer at them, but I'm not embarrassed by them. But they're not going to be as hot as a jalapeno.
It's even a Pacific Northwest jalapeno.
Yeah.
It's a coastal maritime Northwest jalapeno.
Yeah. So having said that, I mean, you can still get some heat, you know, and if you're willing to grow them in some sort of a greenhouse, contrive a greenhouse, you can grow your peppers, and that's going to help kick that heat in. But it's still never going to be as hot as a pepper grown, you know, in the Southwest.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not. And so for me, I'm like, I don't really like super hot peppers anyway. I'm just going to confess that straight up. Not a hot,
you're not
hot,
a ghost
hot.
Pepper eater.
No, I've never understood the point of that. Why would you eat something that potentially could kill you because it's so hot? And at a certain point, all you taste is the hot.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But
I know people.
Yeah,
you know.
I know. I like flavorful peppers. I like things that.
Serranos are so, I mean, I have never tried to grow those here, but no, that's one of my favorite peppers.
But it's just, I mean, to me, like thinking about if you get fixated on the thing that you want to grow, but that you can't, you often miss this whole world of things that you actually really can grow well here. And a general rule of thumb, I think, are like smaller fruited mm-hmm. things where the actual fruit is smaller and an earlier season, shorter season.
These are on the seed packets or on the plant starts as like the day that
yeah,
they'll show
like days to
65
maturity.
Days or
and that's also a guideline.
Yeah.
I would say, I mean, when those kinds of things are determined, one of the things you have to understand is like that 65 days to maturity for a certain variety of tomato or squash or whatever, that may have been determined, you know, somewhere in the Midwest, you know, mm-hmm. wherever that plant is being grown or mm-hmm. bred or the seeds are being trialed. And that may not be true in Cannon Beach, you know,
right.
Or in Astoria or in, you know, Nehalem. It may be and even within those three communities, it may be totally different as well.
It's true. Or even microclimates within those communities. Yeah. But those numbers are a kind of a guideline.
Yeah.
And in our climate, we're mm-hmm. looking for things that mature in a shorter time because our season is kind of short.
Yeah. I try to focus on things that are like 100 days or less.
Yeah.
Because it just, but
melons, people are growing some melons around here. The Bricks count isn't high, but still,
you know, I will say, so one thing that blew my mind last year, and I'm doing it again this year. So our farm is taking part in a dry farming trials through Oregon State University. And so we're growing different crops in an unirrigated, not irrigated.
These things are so
exciting. It's so cool. So you plant the things and you water them a little bit at planting time, and then that's it. You never water them again. And it's only certain crops that are
squash.
Dry beans, tomatoes, deep rooted things. Mm-hmm. And so there's a zucchini we've been growing for a while that does really well. But last year was my first year to trial some melons, and melons are hard out here anyway,
mm-hmm.
Because we don't get the heat And often they're very long days to maturity crops. But I trialed one. It was called Christmas watermelon. And I looked at the description. I'm like, I just really have to try that. And I think I only got like 3 plants to germinate. And it was really hard to tell when they were ripe. And I only had 5 watermelons. And it was killing me. Like, oh, but I finally had to pick one because all the signs on it indicated that it was possibly ripe. I wasn't sure. And so I harvested it and we cut into it one day on the farm. I had some folks there and it was just, oh, the palest pink. It was only just starting to turn. And it was this beautiful big melon, but it hadn't quite turned yet. But we tasted it anyway, and it was delicious. It was delicious. And so I'm growing that one again. Hopefully they'll mature.
Yeah.
Planting them a little bit earlier. But part of the reason it was called Christmas watermelon is it's like a long storing watermelon. So you're supposed to be able to store it until Christmas.
Oh, interesting.
So I didn't try. The ones that I harvested didn't quite make it to Christmas. But I'm going to try it again this year and we'll see. But so there are things that you can try. I mean, melons are hard because they're also a big sprawling plant, like a lot of the pumpkins and winter squash and things like that. And some of those you can grow up a trellis.
Yes.
And others maybe not. You know, another one we've grown on trellises is spaghetti squash. I mean, they're a little bit big, but they can, you can trellis them.
I've done that on fencing, like chain link fencing, not terribly attractive, but there.
Yeah.
And to see, it's really fun to see the squash forming up above like that.
Yeah.
Some of them stayed pretty small with the spaghetti squash. Yeah. I don't know. In the valley when I was a kid, I remember
they
these huge things.
Yeah.
But
mine mostly stay pretty small.
Yeah.
But they're also delicious
they
as
are.
Well. I mean, I think that...
Keepers. Yeah. Some of those things that we can... Yeah, grow in a trellis and then store.
Once I learned to stop treating spaghetti squash like spaghetti, it changed everything for me. Because when I was a kid, my mom used to make it and then put pasta sauce over it. And
I'm like,
these are not noodles. It's not the same thing. But then we started doing other things with it and just roasted, treating it more like a winter squash.
Right.
And it was revolutionary. So, yeah. And I think just that, like, thinking outside of your normal, like, looking at the flat space in your garden and just thinking that's all you have. It's amazing when you start to go up or out or put in a container over here.
How much more food we can grow.
Yeah, and flowers in the same
too.
Space. I mean, I don't want to neglect the flowers. I think the flowers are really important as well. I love flowers. Life would not be beautiful.
Yes, the sweet peas growing up the trellis. Probably going to get a lot more. You're probably going to get a lot more attention for those sweet peas than
You are, yeah.
And those spaghetti squash.
You do. Yeah, I think more people get excited about sweet peas. But flowers are also really important for attracting beneficial insects and pollinators. And I feel like combining those into a garden, even if you're mostly focused on growing food crops, making sure that you have flowering plants is so important.
Can you think of it? I've never thought about this before, but a percentage... thinking about the percentage of pollinator-friendly plants in your garden to foliage plants. I have never thought of that, but I just...
Of like what would be a good percentage?
Yeah, what would be a good percentage?
As much as you're comfortable with.
Yeah, as much as you can do.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't go less than like, certainly not less than 10%, but more than that. If possible. And the nice thing is that sometimes they can, you know, serve a dual purpose where, you know, there are flowers like, you know, strawberries will flower first and then set fruit. You know, there's lots of plants that flower before they produce something. And those flowers themselves are something that, you know, bees are pollinating and moving around to. But bringing in other plants that are also attractive to them or that are also attractive to beneficial insects that are going to be the predators of the insects you don't want. That's where I think getting the combination of those things can be so important. And a lot of the really beautiful annuals that we grow, things like, you know, cosmos or sweet alyssum or
snapdragons
or, and
I know some of the things that are calendula.
Calendula, which and nasturtiums
and some of these things can almost be cover crops. I know in my home garden and many of the places that I'm working in right now, this is kind of the last pull for some of the things that I've let overwinter, like calendulas, the serenthe. These have turned into enormous plants in some spaces in my garden. I've already ripped out many of them to make room for mm-hmm. lettuces and some of the things, the first things that I was planting. Now I'm on to the second springtime wave where there's other things coming. I feel like I have more bee food around. There's other blooms mm-hmm. happening. So I am clearing the space of calendula, serenthe, some of these things that I used almost like a cover crop where I didn't get cover crops in, where mm-hmm. I used that during the winter to protect the soil. I've let them come up and start blooming and be bee food for the year. And now I'm pulling those things out and actually using those spaces for more planting space.
That's a great way to look at it and to think about, you know, again, maximizing your space.
Yeah.
And not being afraid to let things go and see what happens.
I still keep, you know, there will be the calendula I'm still leaving. There will be the mm-hmm. volunteer nasturtiums that I'm still leaving. I try to look at the space and think, can that possibly fit in here with everything else that mm-hmm. I want to come in?
Yeah.
And some of it can't.
I know.
And then it makes beautiful compost.
It really does. I know. I've learned to not feel so bad when I have like 50 nasturtium plants germinating and thinking, oh, I have to try and save every single one. Like, you know, maybe I'll save 10.
Yeah.
The rest of them are compost. Or they can go in a salad because nasturtium leaves are delicious and wonderful. And you can eat them too. So I think there's lots of ways that you can be thinking about your gardens this time of year. There's so much growth that's exploding and so much great stuff that's happening. And I just want to give a shout out too that, you know, for a lot of people, maybe you can't grow everything that you like to eat. But it's early June. It's the beginning of the summer season. And a lot of our local farmers markets here in the coastal area are starting up in early June. Some have already started in late May, but a lot of them are starting in early June. And so if you can't grow it, head out to the nearest farmers market near you and see if one of our fabulous Pacific Northwest farmers is growing it. Because there's a lot of great stuff just starting to show up. You know, lots of leafy greens and radishes and turnips. Strawberries are starting to ripen. Mm-hmm. So much good stuff. So head out to your nearest farmers market and find that kind of stuff too if you can't grow it. Or be inspired to maybe try and grow it in your own garden.
Exactly.
I know. Yeah, it's a combination of those things. I know. I want to also give a shout out to stay tuned because Carol Newman is coming up after this show with lots of fabulous music. And maybe put a little music on your headphones and head out to your garden this afternoon and make some trellises out of unusual things. Jessica, thank you so much. It is always inspiring.
Thank you,
to
Teresa.
See what you're doing in the garden and to hear you talk about different ideas for ways to get the most out of your growing space.
Thanks for having me.
Oh,
it's always
for
a
being
good time.
Here. I know. Thank you so much for joining us for In Season. Thanks to Joanne Rideout for engineering. And get out in your gardens, and we'll talk to you next time.